Join us for the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society's annual conference. It's happening October 24th through the 26th in New York City. This year's theme, Rethinking Paradigms, Innovative Approaches for Optimal Wellness. And it's not just for healthcare professionals. Teachers, parents, and curious minds are invited too. We've got a phenomenal lineup of keynote speakers. Dr. Thomas Campbell, physician and co-author of The China Study, bringing insights on nutrition and lifestyle medicine. And Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, trauma expert and author of The Body Keeps the Score, who practically rewrote how we think about trauma. I'll be chatting with some of this year's speakers in upcoming episodes of Healthy Brain, Happy Body, so stay tuned to get a sneak peek and maybe even a little inspired. Find the registration link in the show notes. It's 3 days of inspiration, insight, and community you won't want to miss. Here's what Angelica Sadar, Executive Director of NRBS, is looking forward to.
I am super excited about this. We've been putting a lot of energy into the planning. We're going to have the hotel is awesome. It's a small boutique New York hotel that has just like lots of fun nooks and crannies, and it's right in the heart of Soho. We're partnering with a school. We're partnering with a consortium of schools. It's a total of at least 17 schools that are going to be partnering with us. So we're going to have information that's relevant for educators, for parents, for clinicians, and we're all going to learn from each other and interact with each other. There's lots of activities planned.
So join us in New York City, October 24th through the 26th. Find the registration link in the show notes or at nrbs.org. We'll see you there.
Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Today we are joined by two guides, collaborators on a book about integrating psychophysiology into psychotherapy. Dr. Patrick Steffen is a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University in Utah, where he served as the director of clinical training. He also serves as an associate editor for the Journal of Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. His research interests include behavioral medicine and integrating biofeedback into psychotherapy. Dr. Donald Moss is a clinical health psychologist, as well as the dean of the Graduate College of Integrative Medicine and Health Sciences at Saybrook University in Pasadena, California. Dr. Moss is skilled in hypnosis, biofeedback, guided imagery, and lifestyle medicine. He also is a master teacher of all things psychophysiological. I talked with them about their new book and how we might think about psychotherapy from a psychophysiological framework. Listeners, we are continuing what is turning into a summer of book discussions. As anyone with an interest in mind-body health knows, physiology and psychosocial experience go hand in hand. As a clinician, it's a real challenge to keep up with the psychotherapy literature, let alone the many other related fields like neurology, cardiology, gastroenterology, et cetera, et cetera. A recently published book focuses on our growing understanding of physiology's impact on our psychosocial experience and how clinicians like myself can integrate that understanding into psychotherapy. We're fortunate to be talking with Drs. Patrick Steffen and Donald Moss about their new book, Integrating Psychotherapy and Psychophysiology. The volume targets clinicians and argues that in order to provide best care, psychotherapists need to understand and utilize physiologic principles. Welcome, both of you, to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And thank you for this opportunity for a good podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's really my privilege. It's a great book. And as I was telling you before we started recording, it's made its way to sort of the top of my pile, and I do reach for it frequently. So one of the things I'm curious about is kind of what brought you into collaboration in the first place for this? I know you've worked together before and you certainly know each other, but I think this is your first published collaboration. So what's the story behind that?
For me, getting to know Don, I think back in 2014, he invited me to work with Saybrook University. And then just having the opportunities to have conversations with him and realizing we had a lot of similar interests, especially looking at integration of things, psychophysiological approaches like biofeedback within a psychotherapeutic context was top of mind.
Well, I want to give credit to Patrick for the original idea for this book. I got excited when I heard about his plan. I got even more excited when I learned some of the authors he was able to engage for this project. I have a strong interest in heart rate variability, which has such impact on emotion, social engagement, and cognition, all three. And one of the major themes of this book is that anything that enhances heart rate variability, we draw in the parasympathetic nervous system, and we really enhance what can happen in psychotherapy. Now, our authors are diverse, and they approach it from several different standpoints and what their primary intervention would be. But that is a theme throughout the book, and that's what drew me to the project.
Well, and Don, you've been involved with mind-body health, obviously, for many years. What's your origin story? What was there a patient or an experience that you had that really solidified your belief in the integrative approach?
It actually began one day when my dissertation chair called me and said, "How would you like it if I could put you in touch with a clinic that would support your dissertation, would support you during the dissertation?" And I said, "Oh my goodness, what part of being a graduate student don't you understand?" I jumped at the opportunity, and it turned out to be a placement in a psychosomatics clinic at the University of Pittsburgh Health Center. And that changed my life. It changed my career directions. I worked at the Staunton Clinic, which was inside a larger clinic called the Falk Clinic. And our patients typically had all sorts of emotional symptoms, but also physical symptoms. And from then on, I was interested in finding approaches that would help this population. Lots of chronic illness, diabetes, hypertension, chronic pain, heart disease. And I learned dynamic psychotherapy there in my internship, but I also learned that it didn't touch the symptoms much for the patients. They continued suffering their medical symptoms, even though they might be more accepting, they might cope better emotionally. So I became interested over time in biofeedback, hypnosis, and other mind-body interventions, because these really seem to reach the nervous system, alleviates so many physical symptoms. So that's what led me into biofeedback. That's what led me ultimately to this book.
And Patrick, how about yourself? You're in a traditional academic situation. What's your origin story? How did you get involved and interested?
Yeah, it's kind of like Don. I was, as a undergrad, I was always interested in health psych and kind of mind-body issues. And then in the mid-90s, I went to the University of Miami specifically because they have a clinical health psych program. So I was trained from the very beginning kind of to take an embodied approach, that it's mind and body together that we want to look at. So there's always a little bit of like a, we didn't do biofeedback in Miami, but there's a psychophysiological aspect that we assumed that doing something like CBT had physiological impacts as well as psychological impacts. And so from the very beginning, that's always been the foundation of how I've been trained and how I think about things.
And how did you get involved in or first come across biofeedback? Because obviously you're very involved in that world these days.
It's kind of a funny story. Is back in 2012, the clinic director where I work here at the university, we have a public-facing clinic, you know, to provide services to the community. And he said, "I bought biofeedback equipment, but I don't know how to use it." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll go to AAPB and I'll learn how to use this." Because it made sense within, you know, a health psych framework that this would be a good approach to use. And I hadn't really had the chance up to that point to learn it. And then it was just so exciting for me to go to APB and see that there's a lot of like-minded people that were interested in this. And then start using it here in the clinic that I train graduate students in how to use this. So it's been a great experience.
So let's turn to the book itself. It starts with a section that really goes into physiology and how it relates to concepts like compassion, understanding, mental health. And, you know, I think that the idea of integrating mind and body, it's a lot more common and a lot more acceptable than it used to be. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. So what does neuroscience have to do with compassion?
It's an interesting question. And after I learned biofeedback, I had the opportunity to go to England and train with Paul Gilbert, the creator of compassion-focused therapy. And a lot of people in our clinic were interested in that approach. And I was interested in that approach in general, but also because Paul Gilbert always brings up heart rate variability. He's not a psychophysiologist, but he recognizes that's an important thing to look at. And so he was excited to get involved as well to say, let's measure HRV, like say pre-post compassion-focused training. We have a publication with him, with the people here at BYU looking at that, that shows that to the degree that people improve in compassion, their HRV improves as well. And so that was a really exciting project to be involved with, that it, what was hypothesized actually turned out. Because you know, in research, you don't always get what you hope you're going to see or what you think you're going to see. But in that study, compassion was definitely related to our HRV.
I was just going to say, I can jump in on that. We had a delightful doctoral student several years ago at Saybrook University, and I was able to work with her on her doctoral dissertation. She wanted to study breathing, and she studied three different types of breathing, including the HeartMath breathing patterns. And her interest was in compassion, and she used two different scales, a scale for compassion and a scale for self-compassion. And whichever breathing pattern the research participants used, both their compassion and their self-compassion increased. She did not train them in compassion, didn't do any compassion-focused training. Rather, she modified their breathing, and their compassion was enhanced. So that's really impressive for me. It shows that mind-body linkage, that we can change something in the body, it will change something in the mind.
This connection between heart rate variability and compassion, I think it's sort of a prototype in a way of different physiologic systems and how they emerge in a more, I guess, molar way, psychosocial and personality. What other connections are there in addition to heart rate variability? I mean, I think that's one many people are familiar with. What else have you found physiologically that kind of drives some of the personality or compassion or even pathology that we see?
Well, I could say that one of the chapters in the theory section of the book, the first section, was by Julian Thayer and Julia Wendt. Now, I was already quite familiar with Steve Porges' work showing that heart rate variability enhances social engagement. But what I think Thayer and his approach add is that when heart rate variability is enhanced, it also enhances the functioning of the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is important for mental flexibility. It's also important for inhibiting emotional processes. So when you are able to do something that drives better heart rate variability, what you're getting is social engagement, mental flexibility, and you're also getting emotional regulation. And those are three of the core components of successful psychotherapy.
In adding to that, the first chapter is by Paul Gilbert, and he kind of draws a little bit on Thayer as well. And that's a key part of the CFT approach, is the ability to self-regulate, like in a broad sense, that through self-compassion, we're able to learn self-compassion and other compassion, learn the flexibility and positive social engagement. Because if you read the chapter, he talks about the kind of the defensive side of things, the approach side of things, and then there's the social side of things. And that area tends to be under-addressed in his mind in CBT approaches, that the importance of our social relationships and building positive social relationships, that plays a key role for him in outcome and positive functioning in life, both mentally and socially.
Does a lot of this seem to relate to a cognitive behavioral model of psychotherapy? So you've sort of both talked about reflecting the physiology into CBT models. How does this kind of play out in psychotherapy?
For me, I'm trained as was trained in CBT, so that's kind of like where I begin when I think of things, and then kind of move towards CFT or ACT or other approaches within that framework. But it's really important, I think, how we see the world. So thinking of both Julian Thayer's approach and Paul Gilbert's approach, that our ability to self-regulate or having that mental flexibility that Don was talking about, I think that's key within a CBT framework that a lot of people want to work with, having that mental flexibility, having the ability to engage the world, so to speak, in a more healthy, balanced way.
Well, Patrick, I actually wanted to follow up with something that was in one of your chapters with Joseph Olson. You talk about personality from the research domain criteria framework. Many people may not have heard of that. I'm not sure how new a concept is, but it seems like it's just sort of starting to percolate. And this is a alternative, maybe too strong a word, but it's sort of an alternative to the more standard diagnostic, the DSM way of understanding personality and pathology.
Yeah.
Could you summarize the framework and talk a little bit about how we might use it to integrate psychophysiology into psychotherapy?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, that's one of the key functions of the book is how do we have an integrative framework? And I think the research domain criteria, which as you mentioned, it's been developed by NIMH. It's been probably in the last 10 or 15 years that it's even been a thought, so to speak. And the goal is, in the alternative to the DSM, instead of having this categorical approach, you either have something or you don't. They take a dimensional approach, which is, you know, you can have very severe depression, moderate depression, mild depression, or, you know, it's more of a sliding scale kind of thing. So it gives you more accurate assessment instead of saying you have it or you don't. Like there's this really difficult line as a clinician. It's like, do they quite make this diagnosis or not? When we realize it's much more fine-tuned than that as well as how people work. And in the research domain criteria, there's positive emotion or approach behavior. It's kind of overlaps a little bit with how Paul Gilbert sees things. There's an avoidance. And avoidance can be a good thing, right? We want to avoid stuff that's going to be harmful to us. There's a social domain or social relationships. There's a cognitive domain. And there's a fifth domain that I just lost. But these are key areas of functioning. And if you think of these as existing on continuums, we can get a better feel for how people are functioning. So one example that's brought up by Michelle Krask from UCLA, as well as I think it's Bruce Cuthbert, who was originally at University of Florida, is now as part of, I think he's still at the NIMH, is you think of anxiety, for example, you can be too far to the right, for example, saying fear less and you don't take care of yourself, or too far to the left in their language would be you're too fearful that you don't. So either you don't do anything or you could do too much. There's this idea of a kind of a normal curve that you can go either extreme of. You can be not have enough fear or you can have too much fear. And both of those could be interfering with somebody's life, right? Could be causing them problems. I think that's one of the interesting things with the research domain criteria is it gives you a more refined way of thinking about how to integrate psychotherapy and psychophysiology. And if you look at Bruce Cuthbert was a student of the University of Florida. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on this guy's name. Really famous psychophysiologist. But he was, Bruce Cuthbert's like clinical health psychologist, I guess, in that sense, of bringing in the psychophysiology side of things into psychotherapy. So I think it just provides an excellent framework for considering these things. It's not the only framework, but it's a great framework. You might have also heard of the high top approach, a hierarchical typography of psychopathology, which also takes a dimensional approach. And we bring that up in the chapter with Dawson Hedges, which is about psychopathology. And we talk about the RDoC and the high top approaches of taking a dimensional look at these things. And because in psychophysiology, of course, everything's going to be dimensional, like when we measure HRV or blood pressure or whatever the variable might be, we take a dimensional approach. And we also want to do that within the psychotherapeutic approaches, look at things dimensionally and not categorically.
Well, and I think that has clinical implications. It sounds like research, you know, when you first hear about both dimensional and hierarchical approaches. But when you think about the average patient, they can be so self-critical of themselves because they have negative thoughts or negative emotions. And yet, if you take that balanced perspective, it may be important to reduce the overwhelming, the pervasiveness of negative emotion. But on the other hand, the goal is not that we'll only have positive emotions, positive affect. That's not particularly healthy. It's not particularly adaptive. So I think this gives permission for people to have the full range of experience.
Yeah, exactly. And they bring up in the RDoC that negative emotion has its place. You know, you can have too much and be too much depressed feelings or anxious feelings. But in their place, feeling some anxiety can be very healthy, like on crossing a road and a car almost hits you. That anxiety is very useful, providing that burst of energy to get out of the road or whatnot. So having that, as Don was saying, having that balance of the appropriate, there is an appropriate amount of all emotions, that there's a reason we have emotions. They can go astray or become too much or too little, but there is a balance that can be healthy for us. And that's part of the RDoC and high top approaches.
So thinking about all aspects of our experience as existing within a range or a continuum. I know when we talk about physiology, we often talk about the ranges that, for example, the autonomic nervous system keeps our hearts within a particular range and our organs within a range, the brain functioning, everything is sort of oscillating. And this is a way of kind of looking at it from a more molar perspective, the range of personality factors that we're living with. And I can see where that would be a more complex approach than our diagnostic approach. And we don't necessarily need to get into critiquing our healthcare system or our diagnostic systems. But I can see where we're sort of using a similar metaphor at all levels, this idea of range and the question of adaptability of a particular characteristic. So anxiety is not bad. It's sort of we need to understand it in terms of both context, but also kind of intensity. So the book, in particular in this first section, is drawing from a lot of different disciplines. And I guess this is sort of a framework to think about it, this sort of idea of things on a dimension, or whether it's the high top or the research domain criteria framework. These are all sort of frameworks to think about. Is there a way to put together sort of a unified framework for psychotherapy?
I would think so, but there could be, you have three psychologists in the room and you have three different versions of that.
At least, yeah.
Yeah. So I think for Don and I, that's something we'd like to continue pursuing. We're starting to write another book on stress. For me anyways, stress is foundational. So I think stress is part of life, and how we cope with stress can contribute to resilience or can contribute to fragility, if we're not coping well. And with my stress mindset, that's my cookie cutter in a sense of how I see the world of how do we cope with these things. And a lot of times in therapy is kind of starting with that question of, how are you coping with what's going on? And thinking of from at least starting from a behavioral perspective of what are some things we could look at that might be more beneficial. So for me, it's stress is kind of the unifying factor that, underlies. If you look at depression in the DSM, it'll say one of the major predictors of someone's first major depressive episode is some significant stressful event. Of course, anxiety and stress, highly overlapping concepts. They're not identical, but they overlap a lot. And so I think how do we cope with our worlds is a great place to start in thinking about this integrated model.
I've got to draw attention to one more of Patrick's chapters. He wrote a chapter with Joseph Olson on, is that the one? No, the one you wrote with Travis Anderson, Affect as a Foundation for How We Know and Understand the World. Patrick emphasized his origins in CBT, but one of there are really two major gaps to CBT, and one of them is inattention to the power of affect. Affect is how we mediate our engagement in the world and how we experience the world. And Patrick's chapter really addresses that. In my own development, way back in the 1980s, a man at Michigan State, Robert Zients, wrote a journal article for the American Psychologist called The Primacy of Affect. And that really swayed me in the direction of paying more attention to affective dimensions. And I think Patrick, along with Travis Anderson, brought us up to date with that. They drew on some very philosophical sources out of the existential tradition and really conceptualized how must we include affect. And with that, how do we include physiology? Because physiology and affect go hand in hand. When I quiet physiology, I'm making modifications in affect at the same time.
Yeah. There's an example. I mean, a part that Travis wrote about how we feel today has a lot to do with, for example, how well did I sleep last night? How well I've been eating, how much physical activity I've been getting. And those all impact kind of our affective sense of well-being, our sense of the world. Is it at its core is kind of an affective feel of how am I doing? Thinking of ourselves as like embodied minds, for example, is a term that's used today, or embodied cognition. And that's directly impacted by our affect or our sense of, am I doing well? And we don't even necessarily consciously are aware of it. Like we just feel bad or we don't realize that's impacting our interactions. But the truth is we just didn't sleep last night and we're just cranky. And then where our interactions with others are cranky because physiologically we're just not doing well. We didn't rest well. Or if we ate something that wasn't good for us or we're not getting physical activity, all of these are impact our sense of self and our core affect. Or like Lisa Feldman Barrett is someone that we cited a lot from. She's in Boston somewhere. There's so many universities there. I'm not sure which one it is, like Boston University or Boston something. She argues that our core affect is kind of like a barometer of our well-being, that if you can get at that, you're getting at kind of the core of the person. And I think biofeedback as one approach that can help us be aware of our kind of our core affect or our core physiology is tied into that. And as Don was saying, when we're able to kind of quiet that or balance that or regulate that, whatever the, you know, different ways we could look at that, then we're having a big impact on our, I think not just our physiological well-being, but our mental well-being that's going to impact how we approach the day or interact today and how we're doing.
So physiology as a sort of a foundation for how we're doing and perhaps expressed as affect even before. And I can't remember, but more recently there's been some work on affect as the assessor rather than cognition as the assessor. So in traditional cognitive behavior therapy, although they talk about the triangle of cognitions, behaviors, and feelings, it really is cognition that drives emotion, that drives feeling.
This will flip it and say affect drives cognition.
Right, right. And it can be either way. I mean, that's the point of it being a triangle. And it really, in my experience, whatever that's worth, and I'm a cognitive behavior therapist, and what I've done is I crossed out the word feeling and put physiology into that triangle.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't think I was the first to do that, but particularly in my work with chronic pain. But just this idea that assessment is not necessarily a cognitive feature, it's an affective feature. Now, there are those who would argue that affect really is cognition with a little something thrown in to spice it up. But it is a way of sort of, it makes a lot of sense and it sort of fits with, I think, people's experience.
Yeah. And I think what we see is that CBT is right. It's correct. There are distortions in our thinking that produce much of the pathology. But I've worked a lot with panic disorder, and my panic disorder patients will come to me and they'll say, I've learned all this stuff that I'm supposed to do when I get anxious. But when I get anxious, I can't think of it. Well, we know what happens in the brain. When you're in a panic, you're hypocapnic, you're deficient in carbon dioxide, and there's diminished blood supply to the brain. The brain isn't working. So I teach people to slow their breathing as soon as the panic hits. And before long, they're starting to remember all those lovely cognitive strategies. So when you put the two together, it's much more effective.
And just responding to something that Saul said, There's a provocative paper by Lisa Feldman Barrett that she argues that affect and cognition are really just part of a continuum, that affect is kind of that quick sense of things and cognition is more of a deeper dive of let's think about the situation, whereas affect is this, oh, this seems good or this seems bad. And then cognition comes along and says, well, what, why? Or like think about it more deeply. And so taking this kind of, she takes kind of a phenomenological approach to it and say, what do we really mean by these terms? And they're really not, the more we're looking at current cognition research, that there's a lot of overlap between how we use the term affect and how we use the term cognition, that there's research that shows affect does make judgments. We usually think cognition is about judgment. Well, we make affective judgments on things. So there's conceptual, I don't know what the word is, but seep in between the two of them, that they're not clearly distinguishable anymore.
I think it's an effect of trying to create an understanding of something that doesn't really care what we call it. Social construct. We will continue the conversation with Drs. Patrick Steffen and Donald Moss on the next episode of Healthy Brain, Happy Body. You can find out more about them and their work in the show notes. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us to get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. This year, NRBS will gather in New York City from October 24th to the 26th. Be sure to join us. All opinions expressed on Healthy Brain, Happy Body are those of our guests, and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.